like to try to get around to answering these questions at some point this evening, because they are about a little bit about meditation, I suppose. These two, anyway. And thought that it. I just thought that it would be right, proper, at some point to actually mention and talk a little bit about. Maybe it won't be important to you, all of you, but sometimes you might encounter some difficulties in your meditation. As I say, with all of you, it seems not much. But to actually talk a little bit about the hindrances, and they are described as food for ignorance. Things are dependent. Things exist because of food, because of nutriment, ahara, and the nutriment for ignorance is actually the hindrances, because they stop things being clear, I suppose, is the short description of them. And I've held off talking about them too much so far, because I hope that I talk a little bit more positively about meditation, so I encourage you to actually experiment and play with it and not be too concerned about the hindrances, because I've spent time listening to talks about hindrances and then spent many meditations wondering where they are. And that's, of course, a hindrance. But so if you're not experiencing hindrances, don't go around looking for them. They just might be something that is around from time to time, and it might be worth having some description of them, some way of recognizing these dhammas. Actually, they're actually dhammas, and so the relationship to them in terms of satipatthana is to treat them as dhammas, and so they can be contemplated and recognized as such. And if they're recognized as dhammas, and then of course they're completely transformed. This is the Vajrayana again. This is the way to transform the hindrances, is to just see them as dhammas, and all the sort of suggestions and recommendations for trying to get rid of the hindrances are actually just that much. In the end, they come down to transforming them into dhammas, and then if they're just seen as dhammas and just recognized as dhammas, then you're practicing in the Satipatthana again, and your practice will lead only one way. It will lead to enlightenment. The Satipatthanas again, the body, the feelings, the citta, and dhammas. And one of the lists of the dhammas, it all begins with, is the five hindrances. It usually ends with the seven bojangas, or factors of enlightenment. And maybe we'll get round to those and be a little bit more cheerful by the end of this talk, but we'll start with the hindrances. And just they're described in different ways, and of course because the Buddha's teaching was wide, and in different times he talked about things in different ways, but for the moment I'll talk about what it feels like, what the suttas describe it being like, being free from each of the hindrances. The first hindrance usually is talked about in terms of sensuality. Yeah, the hindrance of sensuality. Usually, this manifests in meditation is great fantasies and great time spending embellishing wonderful things that you would do, if only and when and how and because it's nice and and these things. This is called sensuality, and it's called a hindrance, and it's food for ignorance, because it stops you actually noticing what's going on. All of that, and this is little bit. This is a little bit. This could be close. So sometimes in meditation, I see trees, rivers, puddles, even figures. They have the quality of realness, though this does not make me less aware of the shrine room and the sitting there. I accept them and let them pass. My question is, should I make them objects of meditation, or just accept the calmness that is associated with them, with seeing them? Yeah. Don't go wandering down those paths. It's not necessary. To know how to get there, how to make the mind calm is helpful. And people make, sometimes these guided meditations you get on them. Sort of feel good tapes are about, imagining yourself being in this place, and then, you start to feel good and all of this, and it might make you feel good, but it's not necessarily liberating. So it might be calming, and that might be diverting, and that, but it's not necessarily liberating, but it can be more described as a hindrance to real calm and collectedness. And being free from that is described as being free from debt. Yeah, as being free from debt. You know what it's like when you've paid off a debt? Now, what do you feel like when you've paid off a debt? When you don't owe anything. When the credit card, when the mortgage, for some of you, maybe the mortgage is gone. To be free from debt, and the feeling that happens when there's a sense of freedom from debt. So, and knowing that you don't owe anything, because the pleasure that comes from sensuality is, it's on tick. It's borrowed. It's not not paid for yet. So being free from being just wandering in that sort of space in the mind is like being free from debt. The other way it's described as being as when it's talking about when the mind is talked about as being like water. It's like the water being dyed different colours, quite bright, nice colours, but dyed still rather than clear. So it's seductive. that's its nature. The next one is usually goes the other way, which is getting caught in aversion. Sometimes happens in the mind. The mind just goes in just a whole sense of blame. You get into great fantasies and troubles about blaming, angry, righteous anger. all of this can go, And that's a hindrance, and it's described when one's free from that sense of being free from that is the sense of no longer being sick, no longer being ill. When the headache's cleared, when the cold has gone, when there's no longer a feeling of being ill in some way, that's when the heart is free from that sort of anger. And the water is described as boiling rather than clear. So there's just to give you ideas. I'm not suggesting ways of overcoming hindrances yet, or anything like that, but just noticing for what they are, noticing them for what they are. I'm not even saying they shouldn't be there, because as I say, if you could just know them for what they are, then you turn them into dhammas and transform them immediately, because there's a clarity of what's happening. And in fact, wanting to get rid of them can set up other tensions and problems. But they're not, to know that, to be free from them is, and to know what it's like to be free from them is also helpful. What is described as being free from them. Usually it sort of switches between the two, you start to get a good fantasy going or something like that, and then you start to I can go down into, and sometimes they can all arise quite quickly, one after the other. Get something going, and then get angry that I'm going, and then get tired about the whole thing, and then fall into the next one, which is a sort of sense of sloth and torpor. Being free from sloth and torpor is described as being out of prison, being out of being imprisoned by something. It's the feeling of being in sloth and torpor is actually is actually quite confined. And you don't really have a way out, and the water is muddy. So it's the sometimes the sloth and torpor can come about because it's quite it's actually quite a pleasant place to be sometimes. Just slightly dull. Nothing really happening. Quite calm. And sometimes it can be because it's quite a pleasant thing to do. And it's quite a pleasant thing when you don't really want to notice anything. And it can be very quick. I've known within a minute, going straight into a sense of calm. And then there's the old story about a couple of bhikkhus who sat next to each other. Because, when you're bhikkhus, you tend to sit next to the same person. And one was the whole time, and the other one was like this. And they actually got talking to each other at one point. And, because, sometimes we do talk to each other, don't we? And the one who was like this admitted that a lot of the time he was thinking, I just wish I could be awake and upright, like my friend next. I can't seem to get myself awake and upright. And the other one was, I wish I could be calm and peaceful like that one. Honest. the sort of sloth and torpor thing can sometimes be one of just because it's a pleasant place to just be peaceful in, and you don't have to do very much, and the time passes. Sometimes it can pass reasonably quickly, sometimes it can pass really slowly, sometimes you can fall into a sort of sense of torporousness and wake up, and it will only have been a couple of minutes, but you would have gone miles away. At least I will. And so to recognize it's like entering a prison and being free from that is being out of prison. The other reason for doing it is because is actually out of aversion. Goodbye, cruel world. It's the old duvet syndrome. Hide under the duvet thing. And just then I don't have to worry about anything at all. It's all gone. Don't have to notice it. And that's another, you know, usually those two. Those are the two, often the two reasons that one gets into sloth and torpor. But being free from it, it's like, as I say, being out of prison. Get out of prison, sprung. Or getting out of the sort of muddiness. The next hindrance is restlessness and worry. Yeah? When you can't really settle at all. You know, the mind's just so... And the whole time, just restless, worry, can't settle down, nothing seems to be right. Moving, shifting. I can only do it because I know it. Don't worry. It's not something I'm not familiar with. So, there's nothing... and I don't recommend, I really don't recommend living in those areas. They're not, that's why I didn't really mention them at the beginning, because, you know, sometimes just mentioning these things can encourage people to sort of experiment and see whether, just how restless you can become or just how, and you need to be really, really skilled if you're going to do that. Very, very skilled if you're going to do that. Ajahn Sumedho talks about working with anger in that way, as you probably have heard him say sometimes. He really, really loved and respected Lumpo Cha. Okay, let's be really clear about this. But at times, there were things that Lumpo Cha would do that could be perceived and one could get really, really irritated by. And Ajahn Sumedho at times used to just figure out just how irritated he could get. but not acting upon it, certainly not saying anything, not doing anything, but just sitting there and seeing just how furious he could be with Ajahn Chah. I don't recommend that necessarily, but it unless you really have a clear idea of what you're doing and your intention behind it. Because what he was doing was noticing and really using that as Dhamma. Noticing how it works. Like just as when Lumpo Cha said to that person who said that she was always angry back in 1970, whenever it was, 79, at the Manjushri Institute, who asked her what should she do with her anger, and he said, put your clock in front of you and see if you can stay angry for 2 hours without a break, without any break whatsoever. That was when that picture was taken of him. He was holding up a flower. You sometimes see that picture of Ajahn Chah holding up a flower, because he was actually talking about impermanence. Anyway, I digress. That's anger. And it was restlessness, and being free from that is like being no longer being a slave, no longer being a slave, no longer having to do what somebody tells you to do. Yeah, it's the weekend time, most. it's when you no longer have to be told what to do, and you no longer have to obey the orders of a master. Being free from restlessness and worry. Worry is an incredibly tyrannical master, isn't it? Worry, 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 worry. Worry about anything and everything. My mother says she can only worry about one thing at a time. She's pretty clever, actually. Because, but I know, because I know some people, she can only worry about one of her children at a time, or one thing at a time. She does manage to do one thing after another, though. It's like being enslaved, worrying, restless and worry. So do be free from restlessness and worry, and do notice when it's there. And the last one is doubt. Doubt. Am I doing this right? Am I doing this wrong? Is this the in-breath or is this the out-breath? You should be able to tell the difference. Where am I experiencing it? How am I experiencing it? Is the mind calm enough or is it not calm enough? How calm should it be? This sort of doubt is the doubt of that's a hindrance, because it's not when it goes round and round in circles, it's not an investigative quality. It's when it stops you from actually committing, and from actually noticing what is actually going on. One is spending one's time doubting about what one should do about what's happening. Should I move? Should I not move? And this sort of stuff. And being free from doubt is like they described it. Like, again, it's probably not something that, I don't know how to put it in modern terms, but. Because in the scriptures, it's having gone over a long journey through a desert, and having got to the other side, having reached having reached the other side of a desert, having finished a long period of time without any sort of sustenance. In the UK, that's possibly a little hard to imagine, but maybe there's a way of thinking. Well, because also we don't tend to spend time without food or drink very often for very long. Very, very little time to actually not have access to that. So we don't really know what it feels like to have that sort of deprivation and not have access to it. But if I can, you know, sometimes one's been on a long train journey. Well, for bhikkhus, this does happen, actually, because you've forgotten to pack your water and you can't buy any water because you don't have access to plastic or coin or notes. So you can spend quite a lot of time sometimes without having water, and it does feel good when you get to the other side and you actually do get some access to it. That sense of actually having arrived somewhere and being sustained is like the feeling of described as a feeling of being free from doubt. I think of the water, it's all sort of tangled up, but maybe I've got those two wrong, mixed up. But those are the things that actually feed and are food for ignorance. So it's as well to know them and to know them clearly. Now they've got sort of classic antidotes and for the sloth and for the sensuality, a supagamatam for that's contemplating things as not so attractive, contemplating the unattractive nature of things or breaking things down. The anger, it's the metta, and for sloth and torpor, the sense of vigor and a sense of effort into things, and different types of ways of getting over being sleepy. 10 different types of ways of getting over sleepiness, pulling your ears, rubbing your eyes, opening your eyes, visualizing light, running through Dhamma that you know, walking meditation, and finally the way of clearing sleepiness, that final one, the one that one jumps to first of all, lying down mindfully on your right side with the determination to get up as soon as you have gotten over any sort of sense of tiredness. It's not the first thing you do, but then restlessness and worry. For that, more the sense of again metta and coming is coming into a sense of calming yourself, calming the thing down. And doubt, trying something, asking if necessary, asking about what one should do is fine, finding a way of doing that. But it comes down to the real work in the transformation is when they notice as Dhamma and transcended in that, in the moment of actually practicing. This is what it's like, and this is the ending of it. And this is where it leads into the Bhojanga, I've described what it's like, the hindrances, and then you need to know, possibly, well, for the sake of completeness, maybe we'll go to the seven ways and limbs, or ways that enlightenment is described, factors of enlightenment. I think they're sometimes called the Bhojanga. And the reminding of this is actually a cure for sickness. For many Buddhists, it's a chant that they learn as a cure for sickness. The Bhojanga. And the first factor is the one that you've been mentioned so many times, Bhojango Sati. That recollection, remembering what you're doing in the moment, collecting this sense of being here, and knowing this is what's happening, and having some presence of purpose to know this is the beautiful thing to do here. This is the thing that's in accord with Dhamma here. And that's what Sati is about. And the next factor is the investigative quality of investigating Dhamma, being really interested in Dhamma. Bhojango Sati Sankato Dhamma Nam Vichayo Tadam Dhamma Vichayo. Being interested in Dhamma, being interested in the truth, being interested in that which is apparent here and now, the qualities of the Dhamma that we haven't actually chanted this time, but are there in the chanting book, the qualities of the Dhamma, the six qualities of the Dhamma, well expounded by the Buddha, apparent here and now, beyond time, inviting and or encouraging ones to investigate something about beauty in there, leading inwards to peace or leading onwards to peace, depending on which preposition one particularly likes, and where inside and outside is for you, and then realizable each wise person for themselves, being really interested in the Dhamma. That's a factor of enlightenment, being interested in to really know what's the way it is right now. And virya is the next one, actually having a sense of vigor about it and getting on with it, So not taking the whole thing for granted, but actually willing to be vigorous in one's application